Hello, this is Will the Werewolf, and this is Werewolf the Podcast. We're on episode 6. Please go back and listen to the other 5. It will make a bit more sense. I'm currently being interrogated by the British Army. What they've asked me to do is tell them a story about one of my most recent kills. And this story is called Mother Bear. She stands guard in front of her children. They cower behind her in the corner of the room. A little boy and a little girl. The mother stands against me. She stays her ground before them. She's ready to die to protect her cubs. She will in time. Well, she won't protect them, but she will die. She will die. Motherly love is a powerful thing. It takes the weakest and makes them super strong in will and physicality. It brings a resolve like no other person can have in a situation. We often hear of the mother who rescues her child from that terrible accident. The one where a car or something is sadly crushing the poor kid. Somehow, Mummy Dearest develops superhuman strength, lifts the object that weighs many more times than herself, and frees the child. Well, when dealing with me, I'm afraid that is, well, it's not an accident in the first place, it's just fate. Unfortunate fate. Funnily, she has a kitchen knife in her hand and points it towards me in a most threatening manner. Her whole body vibrates as she stands there with anger and fear rolling off her in equal measures. The knife is wobbling in a loose figure eight as she holds it at arm's length in front of her. She needs to be careful. She could have some fucker's eye out with that. She's in her mid-30s and wearing a pink and white floral dress, all kind of 50s retro chic, with a blue pair of chucks on. She's very cool. Her hair and makeup are somewhat messed up at this point. Well, she has been crying and screaming and rushing around a lot in the past couple of hours. She's been desperately trying to get away from a werewolf. She has a tattoo sleeve on her left arm and she seems a particularly cool person. Shame really, but to be honest, there's plenty more like her in the world, so it won't miss one or two, or in this case, three. I also need to get my rage issues out of my system, so she'll do for that. Her husband, well, he wasn't much use to her, to be honest. He came apart very quickly after having to stop him from escaping down the path, running away from his wife and children to save his own worthless skin. Well, I kind of have to admire him for that in a way. He tried to drive through me with his fucking pickup truck. He charged at me, wheels spinning, aiming the vehicle like a four-wheel weapon. Sadly, that hadn't gone too well for him. He must have hit me at 30 or 40 miles per hour, perhaps, and I'd caught the front of the car and had braced myself as he pushed me down the road, using my feet as brakes to try and slow the truck. I left two lovely grooves in the mud track, and they were created by my heels. His vehicle had stopped after a few yards, and I'd lifted the nose and simply flipped his truck onto its side in one easy movement. It sat with its wheels now spinning and its engine still running. He sat petrified for quite a long period of time in his seat as I patiently waited for him to get out and try to run away from his now destroyed vehicle. After a while, the engine died and the wheels slowly reduced in their number of rotations. Now, nothing could be heard, except for the gentle squeak of one of his rear wheels, and that was still seeming to turn of its own volition. He'd been still and silent for so long in there that I thought I might have actually killed him or maybe damaged him by the accident. I had circled the car, scratching one extended claw over the truck's now not-so-lovely paintwork. The sound was somewhat stimulating. I could smell that he was alive and that he'd soiled himself and was in a very sweaty panic as to know what to do. I waited by the passenger door that now faced the sky. It was his only real exit, as long as he didn't try and kick his way through the windscreen. He started to move around in the cab, and the whole truck shook as he tried to get himself on his feet and pull himself towards the way out. He shoved and pushed at the closed door that was holding him in the truck. On his third attempt, he managed to throw it open. His breathing was now really heavy, and his heart rate was off the charts. His hands gripped the sill of the door hole, and I could hear the effort that the man was undertaking to drag himself out of the truck. He'd just raised his head out of the passenger side of the cabin when, from behind, I quickly grabbed it with a claw and ripped it from his neck. Beautiful blood sprayed from his carotid arteries into the sky like a high-powered hose. His body collapsed into the car, but I knew if I was quick, his head would still be able to move and do stuff for a while. Things like move its eyes and blink and stuff. Honestly, it's hilarious to see. I only found that out recently, so it had been a fun thing to do, to see how long they lasted with no body. I turned his head so he could see me. His face still reacted by twisting into a fearful grimace, and his mouth moved slightly. A silent scream from his opening lips. The silent cry of the dead man. Then it just went. The life, that is. Now it was no fun. I dropped it on the floor. Right! Where are the wife and kids? I thought, rubbing the palms of my paws together in excitement. So much for Daddy Dearest. He was a runaway, a save-your-own-kind-of-skin kind of guy. He probably knew that it was highly likely he would find another woman and start another family if he got away, so it was the most sensible thing for him to do. On the other hand, the mother was a female bear protecting her cublets. She was brave and proud and really needed to be brought down a peg or two, to be cowed by my very magnificence. I turned back into my human form outside the house and silently stepped through the open door. My posit Fenrir came in tow. I was in the kitchen, standing naked and bloody before her. I must have looked glorious standing there, moist with blood, sweat and breathing heavy, muscles corded and skin tight against them, 8-pack on view and my large cock gently swinging back and forth before her. Wait, 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 Mr. Secretary. Make that a humongous cock. She looked all confused and stared at me. She'd seen what I had been and what I was now. She stood determined in front of her children, breathing heavy and shaking. She held the hand of the smallest one and took up a stance to defend them. I smiled and nodded and went over to the kettle on the worktop. I turned it on and started rummaging through the cupboard, searching for tea bags and a mug. As I searched, I found some ginger tea that was, and I was really genuinely impressed, to be honest. "This is my favourite," I said. "Do you want a cup? Can I get anything for the kids? Juice, maybe?" The kettle boiled and switched off in the background. I dropped the tea bag into the mug and poured on the water. It smelled amazingly refreshing, and it slightly masked my own musky smell. What's happening?" she asked, trying to keep the shake of fear out of her voice. I dunked my tea bag, removed it from the mug with a spoon and dropped it into the bin. I could see her still looking at me. She was obviously trying to hide the admiration she held for me. She looked me up and down. She did halt on my groin for a little too long. Who could blame her? I moved to the opposite side of the table and drew up a chair. I lifted my legs and put my feet up on the table as I leant back and blew on my tea, trying to take the temperature down to a drinkable level. I maintained eye contact with her, and a wry smile played across my lips, waiting for her to respond. She dropped her hands from a defensive stance to her hips and turned to talk to her crying children, squatting down to them and hugging them, telling them that it was all going to be okay. No, it's not, I said with a mug halfway to my mouth. It's really not going to be okay, kids. It's actually going to be fucking awful. Horrific, some may say. I'm going to kill you. I am just having a cup of tea in this best dad mug. I lifted the cup and frowned, shaking my head. He wasn't, you know, by the way. The best dad, that is. He was running away and leaving you guys to deal with. Then I pointed at myself. Me! He was an utter piece of shit, kiddies. Not the best dad by any means. I blew on my tea. I'm sure you realise that, though. Now, having said all this, once I finish this marvellous ginger tea, I'm going to decide in which order you will die. I nodded at them with a smile. So, kids, would you rather watch Mummy die first, or would you like to die first in front of Mummy? There are several ways that we can do this, I said, motioning in their general direction with my mug. I could even kill you guys and leave Mummy alive, or maybe leave one of you alive and kill the other two. Maybe even stuff one of you in the back of my car for a snack later on. The decisions a werewolf has to make. It's never easy. Fuck my life. I lay back in the chair and laughed. No, don't you dare, she yelled, spinning towards me and extending the knife again in my direction. I almost spat out my tea. Don't you dare? I could see what she was saying was heartfelt. I got that. I mean, it was beautiful, but then it was all ruined by snot dribbling out of her nose. Yeesh. I pointed at the tissues on the table with a grimace. Why? I leant forward and slammed my hand down on the table. Then the anger fell away from my face and I replaced it with a smile. Have they not got the right to choose? Oh, and I'm sorry, I'll try and not cuss in front of the little ones. I'm really sorry. They don't really need to hear that, do they? Well, actually, I take that back. It doesn't really matter, does it? You know, because I'm going to kill and eat them and stuff. The silence was her only answer. I am going to drink this tea and then I'm going to kill the fuck out of you. I lifted the mug and turned it upside down. And it looks like I've finished my tea. For them, I had said this whilst making my best John Wayne impression. The mug was empty and it was time to make the changes. So I changed into my werewolf form. More on this amazing transformation later. At this part of the story, I pointed and winked at the chief, who was sat now, mouth open, obviously wrapped in my story. My posset, who had been sat at the end of the table all throughout the conversation with the woman, soaked into me. I stood up in one graceful, balletic movement, throwing the farmhouse table to one side. I walked forward, looking down on the little group, as Mama Bear lifted the knife towards me, her righteous indignation vibrating through her well. Hot little body, to be honest. Then I got hit from behind. I had not been paying attention. I had felt a blow on my back and then another on the back of my head. I reached up with a claw and wiped the area on my head before slowly turning around. I brought my paw to my face and looked at the blood covering it. I then refocused on an old lady who stood in the doorway. She was reloading a double-barrel shotgun. Ah, then this must be Granny, I said, licking the blood from my paws. Well, this is a flip reversal of the Red Riding Hood fairy tale. In this particular version, the wolf gets his head blown off by Granny, and she saves the day. A postmodern feminist anti-ageist ending to the classic story, perhaps. Granny pointed the gun from her hip in the direction of my head. I reached for Mommy Bear to pull her towards Granny, but I wasn't quick enough. And Granny, bless her, she got me off both barrels full in the face. I fell to the floor and lay still, knowing it would take a few moments for my eyes to repair at this stage, so that I could see again. My senses were still tuned in on what was happening in the room, and unexpectedly, I had to deal with Mum diving on top of me with her knife and stabbing at my head and chest. I reached out and grabbed her knife and hand in the same, crushing it entirely within my grasp. She cried out once more. I tentatively opened my right eye to gauge where I was in the healing process and if I had my sight back. I could already see pretty well, so holding onto her crumbled arm, I got to my feet and by instinct, I swung Mum in front of me to block the next shot from Granny. Mum was swearing like a blooming trooper, and it was with difficulty I used her as a human shield. I have to admit that she was pretty impressive as she continued kicking at my chest with her feet and spitting in my face. She was fucking awesome. I snatched up Mum's other wrist and held her in the crucifixion position in front of me, her arms outstretched, all messiah-like. She was ready to make the ultimate sacrifice for me. So beautiful. I turned to face Granny again, who had reloaded the 12-gauge with what seemed practiced precision. In this short amount of time, she knew what she was doing. She locked it into her shoulder, sighting down the barrels, and was very, very prepared to fire. Now, Granny, not taking her eyes off me, motioned to the kids to come over to her. Sadly, I was a bit close to them to allow this, so as the boy tried to run past, I kicked him back into the corner. There was a bit of a sickening crunch, and then no more noise from him. Maybe I'd accidentally killed him or something. I wasn't sure at this point, but his sisters just started to cry again. So fucking annoying. So, here we were in stalemate. Granny with a gun and me just being me, with her loved ones as collateral. I had nearly healed and was back looking like my usual self, all black hair and yellow eyes and looking like a sleek bit of darkness to those who saw me, if you could see me. The silence was now palpable, and I could hear the last bit of buckshot drop and bounce along the wooden floor as it was pushed from my pelt on my scalp. Dangling before me, Mum had passed out with the pain, so hung like, well, a dead body, I suppose. She wasn't dead. I could sense it, but her system was in overload, so she would need some quiet time before she came back into play. Granny, on the other hand, looked very serious and started talking to the kids, one lying prone, the other huddled in the corner of the room.
Jenny! Don't worry, Jenny. It's all going to be okay. Is Jason okay? Check, Jenny. Is Jason okay? She asked the tiny Jenny.
Jenny and fucking Jason. What a lot of imagination used there in the naming of these poor little gets. I looked over at Jenny and saw her kneeling in tears next to her brother, who was very still, and I could sense very dead. I noticed his head had hit the stove in the corner and smashed like the famous Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall, its contents now a pool underneath the damaged skull. Jenny, oh little Jenny, bless her, was trying to scoop his brains off the floor and put them back into what was his head. What did she think she could do? Did she think that she could tape him back together again like all the King's men? Well, they failed. So would she. Kids are so fucking stupid.
Jenny! Jenny! Granny's here. It'll all be okay.
Granny was getting stressed now.
Speak to me, Jenny. Speak to me.
No response from the little Jenny. She had mentally broken down. Kids these days don't have the toughness they used to have. No signs of any resilience. I blame the new culture. It makes life too easy for them from the start, not allowing them to build any emotional toughness. Granny's generation, on the other hand, wow. She was staring down a fucking werewolf to rescue her family. That's toughness. I assume this was Mother Bear's mother, as they had this toughness in common. Well, Granny was a little different. She had a fucking gun, a much better weapon than a kitchen knife, but you do what you can with what you have when you face a werewolf, I suppose. Granny started to circle the room towards the kids. She was motioning me to move with the tip of the gun. I did. This was fun. She was now trapping herself with the kids in the corner. It was going to be interesting to see how she would get these kids out of here. She eventually, sidestepping, got to the kids, and Jenny grabbed onto Grandma's leg and cried out. Without lowering the weapon, Granny held Jenny's head with one hand and stroked her hair as she tried to calm her, shushing her down. Eventually, the child was just quietly mewling in the crook of her arm. What a delightful display of affection. I wanted to vomit. At this point, I swung Mum under one arm and put my hands on my hips and transformed back to my man shape. The posset was now rolling on the floor in laughter at my semi-confusion. Where do we go from here? I asked. I could see her thinking about what she was going to do. I started tapping my foot as I waited for her response. She raised the muzzle of a shotgun in my direction, so I lifted the unconscious woman up in front of myself and told her, "That would not be the best idea you've ever had." She thought about it for a moment. I actually thought she was going to fire the blasted thing in her hands. Then her jaw set, and she pointed the bangy end of the gun at the floor, keeping the stock at her shoulder. She was ready to quickly respond to any threat. The little girl by this time had stopped grizzling and was looking at me while hanging off her grandmother's leg. She was busily in the process of extricating what seemed to be a reasonably large bogey from her nose, which after some work was popped into her mouth for discreet consumption.
"Why? Why are you doing this?"
the grandma asked over the head of the child. As I tried to reply, Jenny had spotted James again and had lost her shit once more, bawling and wailing, snot running from her right nostril. How could such a little thing create so much fucking depressing noise? I tried to speak again, but each time her squeals cut in. Well, I... Jenny's crying butted in. Well, I... More irritating noise from the kid. I'd had enough. Shut up! I yelled, pointing the finger at the child. The adults are trying to talk here. The youngster then went into almost silent sobs while her meemaw rubbed Jenny's head without taking her eyes off me. So I began again. Thank you, Jenny. Well, I could say that it's because I'm a werewolf and that intrinsically means that I have to feed on human flesh. Now, I could say that, but that's a lie, to be honest. I really enjoy torturing and humiliating people a lot. I am a massive narcissistic psycho, or so I have been told. And being a werewolf only means that I can follow my fantasies of killing hundreds of people for my own and internal pleasure. At this sentence, my posit smiled and nodded. He was enjoying the fact that I was genuinely telling the truth. You enjoy this? Do you enjoy hurting people? Is it killing them in front of their families? Destroying beautiful children as you go? Do you murder for pleasure? You're a monster, spat the old lady. I thought about this, resting my chin on my paw. Well, the answer to each question is yes, and also... I agree with your final statement. I am indeed a monster. I'm a fucking werewolf. Just kill me and let the little ones go, she exclaimed. No, you see, it doesn't really work like that, I'm afraid. I've no conscious desire to make out that I'm a better being by letting the kids go. In fact, I have the great pleasure of stopping them from being broken, hurt and damaged by the society that they are entering. I am preventing them from being fed into the machine that will mentally cripple them and destroy them thoroughly. I am doing them a favour. I had to stop and think at this point, as it seemed like I believed what I was saying. Did I really believe I was doing these children some favour by killing them? Maybe I did have some sort of conscience. What? Then I remembered that I might be killing the great mind that discovered the next cure for cancer before it finds the cure for cancer. I might be removing the spiritual leader that brings all of the world together into one happy family and accepted I was just a dick who killed because I liked it. She still looked perplexed and said the old thing that they often say.
Is that fair? They've not done nothing. They're just kids.
The commonplace life is not fair response. So, this comes up a lot, my dear. Sometimes people look around and say that what is happening to them is not fair. You're right. It's not fair. Things happen to you and others that are unfair all the time. People get mistreated by others and just by... happenings in general. The car you're in runs off the cliff and causes you permanent brain damage. That's not fair. Someone else wins the lottery and you don't. That's not fair. Nature is not about fairness. Fairness is a human construct that we all want to follow when it suits us. If something happens to you that you deem unfair, you shouldn't sit there and complain about it. You will just have to accept it and crack on. You might be able to change it for the better, but sometimes bad things happen. I am afraid that this is a bad thing. This concept is something that youngsters, in my opinion, need to try and realise early on. Life does not owe them anything. Human rights are just niceties that a group of people have made up and told us that we all have and deserve. We're taught that they are a fact, but people can actually choose to implement them or not. Certain situations can arrive when those niceties disappear, such as in the aftermath of a disaster, or if you have the bad luck of meeting me on one of my days of the month. The real world does not have those good rules written in it. Rights are a privilege. We've decided to give each other those rights when appropriate. So remember... life isn't fair and you have to deal with that. The things that happen to you are just things that happen. There's no real concept of fairness, sorry. Take this as an educational experience. The kids, well, I presume he's dead. I pointed at Jason, looking at his head and that. I pointed at Jenny. So that kid gets to learn the realities of life. It is a lesson worth learning, although her life is going to be particularly short. This did not seem to make a blind bit of difference to the granny. I mean, I was teaching her some deep philosophy shit here and getting nothing back. Oh, and the other great thing to know is that hope is not a positive thing to have in any way. Again, I will put another fly in the ointment of life. You need to get rid of all hope. No, you are not at the doors of hell. You've been taught to hope. You've been taught that hope is a positive thing. I disagree. I then quoted some Nietzsche. Hope, in reality, is the worst of all evils because it prolongs the torments of man. Albert Camus and several other philosophers you probably have never heard of have resigned hope to being useless, if not a negative characteristic. Is hope an emotion? In the medieval period, it was thought to be a powerful emotion. In more modern times, it's been considered otherwise. But if we look at the work of Averill from the 1990s, we can see that it does hit similar patterns as other emotions, such as love and anger. All are similar in that they are difficult to control. They all motivate behaviour because they can increase a person's persistence, allowing them to get through tough times. Almost all people experience them, and they change the way you think about things that happen. But this does not, well, it does assume love itself is an emotion, with which some people tend to disagree. I do. I don't think it exists. I think it's a mind trick. Why do you hope? If we look at how hope comes about, it's not a natural biological phenomenon. It's a learnt response from others. We're socialized to be hopeful. Hope is discovered at a young age as we learn a language and how to communicate with others. Christianity itself is a religion based on hope. The hope that if we live an ideal life that we will be rewarded in heaven after we die. I took a breath and as she seemed to be lost, you know, deep in my speech, I continued at Granny. When we look at philosophy, like, let's take the example of Stoicism. We see hope is not a real thing or a thing we need. Optimism has its flaws. Hope seems like a great thing. And it is said that when there is still hope, we can still hang on. But what do you do when optimism fails? Or what's the next step when all hope eventually runs out? We cease acting, give up, and have nothing. The best people do not need hope. I don't have any hope. That's why I'm one of the best people. We do not act because of the thought that things might work out. We act because we know to do so, to change things, to get what we need. This viewpoint seems like a very pessimistic outlook on life. Still, I find that catastrophic thinking and the idea of accepting that the world is a horrible place helps me as long as I have an internal sense of control and the coping strategies to deal with the worst that is sent. Being prepared for the worst, in my case, allows me to be ready for it, stopping me from being upset or angry when bad things actually happen. Things happen. It is us that assigns them as good or as bad. The world at this stupid moment is full of positive outlook theory. Do we need to remain positive at all times? I never understand this. I read plenty of self-help books. Take The Secret, for example. It advocates the virtue of just thinking that something good will happen, and that will then make that good thing happen. What a lot of garbage! Listen to Freddie N and you realise that this is not the case. There are so many other pessimists seen throughout philosophical history. Many are great thinkers like Schopenhauer and Voltaire, but Frederick's was way different. Socratic optimism always highlighted things like logic and truth and beauty. Reality to the optimist can be conquered and made and ordered and bettered. On the other hand, Nietzsche's pessimism is cruel, chaotic, and not logical at all. But once understood and accepted, it can be used to get and achieve what you want, or not in some cases, but at least it is easier to deal with. Unlike other philosophers and prophets, Freddy wants us to tackle the reality of life, the fact the world is a dark place full of scary things. Eastern philosophy and some earlier philosophers valued acceptance and the move to get away from the strife to achieve. This tolerance of a nasty reality will lead to becoming a sage or the enlightened. He wants us to move forward with enthusiasm and suffer joyfully, that we should have no expectations, that we should not be waiting for luck or something good to happen. He said that we should not think that things will change for the better, but get out there and know that you're suffering for a reason and do something about it. We should not accept that everything is going to be okay. We should not accept that it will all work out in the end. Blah, blah, bloody blah, blah. We want to get rid of hope. Hope itself is a narcotic, because you can always hope that things are going to get better. And just knowing this numbs the pain of reality. We stop trying to change things because we hope it will all work out. You should envision the worst that can happen and accept it. That way, we can do something to stop it happening or carry on when it does happen, instead of thinking it will work out and become broken when it does not. It also destroys anger, thinking of every outcome. Anger is born when bad things happen to us that we've not planned for. Something that we do not expect to happen makes us angry. Having hope that everything is going to be okay, then finding out that everything is not going to be okay, will at the very least make us angry. Oh, and if you are a true stoic and things get too hard for you to stomach, then we can kill ourselves. Harsh but true. Camus said that the only meaning in life is what gets you through the day without killing yourself. In my opinion, no better purpose in life can be found. Stop searching for a purpose. That is it. That cup of coffee you had was the reason why you are alive in that. Hope is a form of cowardice in my eyes. It is a thing that keeps us from accepting the actual realities of life and prolongs suffering. So abandon all hope and ye shall enter, not through the doorway to hell, but into a better, more fulfilling experience where you can see all the outcomes. Know that you are the one that has to do things to get rid of your suffering. Getting that job will not come about by you hoping it will happen. You need to work towards it. Hope is an external belief system that we've learned. The hope that it works out often does work out. So it is self-perpetuating. If hope fails, then we have nothing. If hope succeeds, it is an external factor you can rely on. So it is always better not to hope. So give up hope at this point, as the worst outcome that you can think of is going to happen. It is not fair. There is no reason to have hope. Accept your fate. You never know. Perhaps you will get a last minute reprieve. I'm trying to say that this messed up situation is not going to change. You and the kids are going to die. So can we just move along now?
I wish you would move on, you self-righteous, prevaricating pile of garbage, replied Grandma as she fired both barrels.
I dropped Mum and leapt. The chief nodded and smiled. Over the next few days in my little hidey-hole of a cell, the hoses stopped and the food was pushed towards me on a long pole by the other two soldiers that seemed to live here. I got to like the chief, although he never in all his time answered one question that I proffered him. He would not even tell me his name. His accent was different every time and impossible to place. He could have been from anywhere, and he had no recognisable traits that would give me an idea of his cultural heritage. Even the Americanisms he used were worldwide, so I thought he was maybe American, but I think those stemmed more from the recent spy movies than anything else.
Okay then, Will. Let's talk about the posit werewolf soul thing. How did that happen then? The chief asked.
Thanks for listening. You can always go down to the description and buy me a coffee. There's a link there if you want. If you don't want to, that's fine. I don't mind. But, you know, just understand this. I love you.